This is podcast number 81 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Arlene Peterson, and today's daily sampler is How Pepper Helped to Discover America. One of the big objectives of studying history for the heart is to help children begin to appreciate the price others have paid that translate into blessings for our own lives, and also to help us to see what we can do to improve the lives of those who follow after us. It's about fostering a sense of gratitude and linking generations together. The sample I'm going to share today comes from a month one book in the middle school exploration section called Explorers and Settlers, compiled by Charles Barstow. I hope it will give you some ideas that you can share with your kids around the dinner table. As you teach the heart, you always want to be looking for connections to familiar things, and most of us have a pepper shaker on the table. By unfolding this story about pepper, whenever they see that pepper shaker on their table, it will call up impressions and reminders of what you've shared with them. So, here is today's sample, How Pepper Helped to Discover America. You'll also notice more lessons on what inspired Columbus to make his daring voyages to layer into your learning. How would you like a pie not only sweetened and spiced, but made hot with a sprinkling of pepper? Or a cake full of fruit and also strongly peppered? I rather think you would call these things spoiled and beg to have them made in a different way. If, however, we had lived some 400 or 500 years ago, we should have thought, like everyone else in those days, that no dish, sweet or otherwise, was complete without the pungent taste of pepper. Perhaps it would surprise you to know that this taste for pepper and the value which was placed upon it played an important part in the discovery of America. In case this last statement seems improbable, let me tell you something of the history of pepper and its importance in the commerce of the world during the Middle Ages. There are a great many common things you know that have very interesting stories belonging to them, and they are generally worth hearing. The native country of the pepper plant is southern India, and its culture there is very old. The berry, or peppercorn, which is ground for our use, is produced on vines which are trained against trees, very much as you may see the grapevines in an Italian vineyard. The berries are dried in the sun and sent to market in bags. Black and white pepper are made from the same berries, but the black contains the ground husk, which the other does not. This addition of the husk gives the darker color and the stronger flavor to black pepper. The old Eastern nations, the Egyptians, the Greeks, and the Romans, all knew and used a great many spices, and among them was always pepper. How soon it came to be so highly esteemed as it was in the Middle Ages is not certain, but as early as 410, when the great northern conqueror Alaric the Visigoth besieged Rome and was induced to retire by taking a ransom, 3,000 pounds of pepper formed part of the treasure he carried away with him. Later on, taxes began to be paid in pepper instead of money, and the Jews, especially, who dealt largely in this, among other spices, were obliged in many cases to give to the government so many pounds of it yearly. In the 12th century, according to an old law, the Jews paid to the Pope a tribute of 1 pound of pepper and 2 pounds of cinnamon. From certain provincial villages, the archbishop received annually from 1/2 to 2 pounds of pepper in payment for allowing the Jews to have a copy of the book of their law, a synagogue, a lamp burning perpetually, and a cemetery. In 1385, the king of Provence imposed on the Jews in his dominions a tax of 60 pounds of pepper. So much traffic in this spice came to the city of Alexandria that one of its streets and a gate were named for it. And as for Venice, an Italian proverb says, "The white and the black have made Venice rich." In other words, it was through the pepper and the cotton brought from the east by the ships of Venice and by her merchants sent all over Europe that the city gained a large share of its vast wealth. In the 15th century, pepper was the article more than any other that the Venetians sent to France, Flanders, England, and above all to Germany. People used to make presents of pepper, Even kings and ambassadors gave and received it. When the Republic of Venice wished to show special gratitude to the Emperor Henry V, they made him an annual gift of 50 pounds of it. After a victory gained by the people of Genoa in 1101, each soldier received, as part of his pay, 2 pounds of pepper. In many countries, there prevailed a curious system which obliged certain persons to furnish, at stated times, pepper in small quantities, in most cases about 1 pound. These payments were called peppercorn rents, and the term has not entirely died out yet. In England, the tax on pepper in 1623 was 5 shillings a pound, and even until this 18th century, it amounted to 2 shillings and 6 pence per pound. You can easily imagine what a high price people had to pay for an article so much in demand, and what an enormous amount of it must have been used. I said that they put it even in sweet dishes, and in fact, the rage for peppered food was so great that it was considered absolutely essential in every sauce. People would not have said then, "I haven't enough salt in my soup, or on my meat, or enough sugar in my pudding, but there isn't enough pepper." You must imagine yourself in the Middle Ages and think of all the difficulties then connected with carrying on business. When our merchants want anything, there are swift ships and fast trains everywhere. All countries are open and we can travel from one end of the earth to the other. The products of India and Africa are at our very doors and we have only to ask to obtain them. But it has not always been so, and we ought to remember the long voyages taken, the weary searching made, the dangers from wild beasts and savage peoples encountered before we, in our time, could obtain so comfortably and easily what seemed to us only ordinary necessities. 400 and 500 years ago, there was, it is true, a great amount of luxury in France and Italy. People wore beautiful clothing, magnificent jewels, and ate choice food. Art flourished, and science made great progress. But at what cost were even the necessaries of living obtained? From the Far East to Europe, how long the journey was, and what months were consumed in bringing over the deserts of Arabia, across the plains and mountains of Persia, under the burning sun of India, or in boats from Syrian and Turkish ports, the things which European civilization required. When we remember the difficulties of the medieval merchants, we can understand one of the principal motives which led so many persons to search for new and shorter routes to the countries where the spices grew and where the land was rich in products which would bring them wealth. It was the love of adventure and the desire to see new and strange places which started large numbers of the early voyagers, but it was, more than all, for commercial reasons that most of the expeditions were undertaken. In the year 1260, there passed through Constantinople 2 Venetians named Maffeo and Niccolò Polo. They were on their way as a matter of speculation toward the east, and by various chances and changes went on until they reached Bokhara in Turkestan, where they felt a long way from home and thought they had made a great journey. But here they fell in with certain envoys on a mission to Cathay or China, and bound to the court of the great monarch Kublai Khan. The 2 brothers were induced to accompany them, and thus became, as far as we know, the first European travelers to reach China. There's no time to tell of how they found Kublai Khan at a place called Cambaluc, the old name of Peking, just rebuilt by him, or of his beautiful country seat at Shangtu, north of the Great Wall. But someday when you read these lines which Coleridge left unfinished and which began, "At Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree," you might remember the visit the 2 Venetians paid the place. The Chinese monarch was delighted to meet these intelligent men from the distant and civilized West, and when they went home he made them messengers to the Pope, begging them to return with teachers and missionaries from Europe. After a long time they did reach China again, having visited home in the meanwhile, And although they had not succeeded in having the teacher sent, they brought with them Niccolo's son Marco, then 15 years old, who became the famous traveler and the first European explorer to write a book about what he had seen. When you read his book, you will notice how often he speaks of the spices of the Eastern countries, and how he mentions pepper as one of the most important articles of commerce in these lands. The Chinese at that time valued pepper so much that they willingly paid 15 ducats for a bushel, and Marco Polo says that for one ship which left India with a cargo of pepper to be sent on to Alexandria, 100 or more went to China. Marco Polo's book made a great impression on his fellow countrymen, and the interest already felt in the unexplored East was largely increased by reading his stories. One traveler after another sailed from the different ports of Italy and made voyages more or less successful in various directions. As at this time the principal traffic of Europe came through Venice, the Venetians were the first to interest themselves in expeditions to distant countries. Every year a Venetian squadron passed through the Straits of Gibraltar and stopped at Lisbon on the way to England and Flanders. The sailors told stories of the eastern countries with which their city carried on commerce, and the Portuguese and Spaniards were the next to catch the exploring fever and began to make voyages of exploration for themselves. They went down the west coast of Africa, making their own one bit of territory after another until, as you know, Vasco da Gama sailed quite around the Cape of Good Hope and showed that path to India. Prince Henry of Portugal, himself a navigator, was largely responsible for these African discoveries, and he was influenced by Marco Polo's book to attempt his own expeditions and encourage those of others. Here in Portugal, pepper was again of importance, for it is said that the desire to find it by an easy and cheap route, and thus to reduce its price, was one of the reasons why the Portuguese were so anxious to get to India by sea. Its price was certainly lowered after the merchants began to bring it directly from India and Ceylon in ships, and it became a monopoly of the Portuguese crown, continuing so until the 18th century. About this time, the culture of pepper was extended to the Malay archipelago, and part of the traffic was turned naturally from Italy to Portugal as being in more direct communication. Now let us go back a little, and this time to Florence, one of the greatest commercial cities of the past, particularly during the 14th and 15th centuries. Her merchants were of the richest in the world, and certain trades and arts flourished there as nowhere else. Among these merchant families was one called Toscanelli, and they carried on business in spices and in other articles usually coming under that head in those days. They sent in every direction for their goods, and every year visited the old Italian town called Lanciano, where was held the great fair of spices, and where merchants came to buy and sell from all countries of Europe, and even from Asia. Here one would be sure to find many travelers and to hear many stories of strange lands and little-known peoples, and here, no doubt, great impetus was given to research in new directions. The Toscanelli family were rich and owned a great deal of property in Florence, and a street in the city still bears their name. There is, too, a fine old villa not far away, which belonged to them nearly 500 years ago. But they are remembered especially for one famous representative of their name, and he was a man whom Americans should hold in great regard. Well known and esteemed in his own day, Paolo del Pozzo Toscanelli has almost been forgotten since by the world in general until comparatively recent times. However, in 1871, at the meeting in Antwerp of the Geographical Congress, all the scholars, historians, and scientists present unanimously agreed in calling him the inspirer of the discovery of America. He died in 1482, 10 years before Columbus touched the shores of the New World, but it was by the chart he drew and according to his plans that the great Genoese laid his course. Toscanelli lived out the whole of his long life in Italy, a hard student, a skillful physician, and a remarkable scientist. He was the founder of modern astronomy and was the first to mention some of the comets best known to later astronomers. His knowledge of mathematics was profound and his interest in geographical researches intense. There is still, in the Cathedral of Florence, the sundial he made, and it has been considered the most perfect in existence. On the death of his brother, he took the place almost of a father to his nephews, and as they carried on the business, he interested himself largely in their success. It was for their sake that, aside from his scientific interest in the voyages of the day, he began to think and plan new routes and ways to the country of the spices. The Turks were interfering with the introduction into Venice, and thus into Italy, of the products of India, and merchants of Florence were beginning to feel the effect of this obstacle to commerce, when Toscanelli declared it possible to reach the east by sailing west. On the chart which he made, he traced a line from Lisbon across the sea to Hangzhou on the Chinese coast, and in a letter which he wrote on June 25, 1474, to his friend Christopher Columbus, he explained his ideas and theories regarding the voyage. At the same time that Toscanelli sent this letter to Columbus, who was then at Lisbon, he also wrote to another person a letter to be given to the King of Portugal. In this letter, among other things, he said, quote, "Many other times I have reasoned concerning the very short route which there is by way of the sea from here to India, the native land of the spices, and which I hold to be shorter than that which you take by Guinea. For greater clearness of explanation, I have made a chart, such as is used by navigators, on which is traced this route, and I send it to your majesty. I have depicted everything from Ireland at the north as far south as Guinea, with the islands and countries, and I will show you how you may reach the places most productive of all sorts of spices. Also, I have shown in this chart many countries in the neighborhood of India, where, if no contrary winds or misadventures arise, you will find islands where all the inhabitants are merchants, especially as there is a most noble port called Zaitau, where they load and unload every year 100 great ships with pepper, and there are also other ships laden with other spices. This place is thickly populated, and there are cities and provinces without number, under the rule of a prince called the Great Khan, which means King of Kings. Here you will find not only great gain and many rich things, but also gold and silver and precious stones and all sorts of spices in great abundance. From the city of Lisbon, you may sail directly to the great and noble city of Hangzhou, where there are 10 bridges of marble, and the name of the place signifies City of Heaven. Of it are told most marvelous things of its buildings, of its manufactures, and of its revenues. This city lies near the province of Cathay, where the king spends the greater part of his time. You have heard of the island of Antilia, which you call the Seven Cities, and of the most noble island of Cipango, which is rich in gold, pearls, and precious stones, and the temples and royal palaces are covered with plates of gold. Many other things could be said, but I will not be too long, and so I remain always most ready to serve your majesty in whatever you may command me." Close quote. With such ideas and these in his mind, you know why Columbus thought he was landing in the Orient when he stepped ashore on the island of San Salvador. He had even brought with him a letter and fitting gifts for the great Khan, or Emperor of Cathay. Today, pepper grows in many countries besides those of the East, though the best still comes from India, and a great deal of business is carried on in its cultivation, preparation, and exportation. It has become an ordinary thing to us, and we expect it on the table as a matter of course. Perhaps, however, when you remember its old importance and that the trade in this spice really did help to lead voyagers toward America, you will regard it as something much more interesting than a mere everyday addition to your food.